Welcome to the Farcast, bringing you insights into Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. It is the 16th day of May. This is about the dead midpoint of the second quarter here. We've got a month and a half behind us, a month and a half ahead of us. Earnings season is over. We've gotten through a Fed meeting and lots of talk, and we've seen inflation data. Some of it looked a little hot. Some of it looked a little, maybe it's coming the right way. But the little meh, coming the right way, what did that really mean? It mean markets went nuts. Markets went nuts, and that was yesterday. And we're back up at new all-time highs, folks, on the S&P 500. Stocks are expensive. Everybody's happy because the Fed's going to clearly have to ease any minute now, which is just silly. It's just silly. Do you hear Kenny Polcari laughing? He's laughing because he knows that's what markets are saying, and he knows how absolutely silly it is when markets start doing this. In the last 6 or 8 weeks, folks, here's some insight as the portfolio manager with a few billion under management here. Been hearing from some of our stronger voiced clients that they don't like these more conservative names in the portfolio. They don't like the old tried and true pharmaceuticals. They don't like the consumer durables. They don't like those safe kind of things. They're slow growth, 8 to 10% growers, regardless of the price with a dividend. Those stocks are boring. I don't want those. Why don't we buy some risk? Now, folks, listen to me. Just for the love of God, listen to the guy that's been doing this for 37 years. When the market's making new all-time highs, you do not add risk. Okay? It's not hard. That's not hard. We could go sit down and talk with your grandmother about that and say, look, it's all-time highs and people are excited. And she'd go, well, this is stupid. If she knew nothing about the stock market, she'd say it was stupid. It's stupid. It doesn't end well. What ends well? I'm sorry. I know what I'm going to say is boring. But it's hard to be boring when exciting stuff is going on. It's hard to be the designated driver at 2 a.m. when everybody else thinks they can have one more drink. And you're looking at him going, you shouldn't have had the last 3 drinks. All right, you're going to get them home safely. That's my job. That's Kenny Polcari's job. That's the job of all responsible professionals in the financial management, financial services industry. And to speak truth to wealth, which is a lot like speaking truth to power, because these rich people can fire me whenever they want. I get fired. And then, you know, they'll lose the money. They will. I promise that's going to happen. That's going to happen. This thing will go down. It doesn't stay at all-time highs. But, okay, fine. Get rich slowly. Work for Warren Buffett. I like the idea myself. Kenny Polcari is the CEO of Case Capital Advisors and the Chief Market Strategist for Slatestone Wealth. Welcome back, Kenny.
Michael, it's a pleasure to be on with you all the time, and I loved your opening monologue. I thought it was perfect. And you talk about boring. Look at what the utilities are doing this year. They're up nearly 14.5%, and they are the most boring sector in the S&P. But look at how well they have performed in this environment.
What's wrong with that? What's wrong with 14.5%?
As far as I'm concerned, absolutely nothing.
You know, if you came back to me, Kenny, and said, hey, I've been looking at small caps, and at this point in the cycle, they've started to move, but they're out of favor, I think, which is what Jim Labenthal's been saying. You know, right. You move, okay, now you've got my attention. You've got something that hasn't performed that is relatively, I don't care what it is. I'm not making any recommendation for small caps or anything else. I'm just saying find something that hasn't been making new highs and has a good, strong fundamental argument or a cyclical argument, historical argument. I want to hear about that. But here's the hottest thing. Come on, Kenny, what are folks doing? Why does this happen? Is it the fear of missing out? And why do folks, why are folks so easily dismissive of folks like us with experience? And why does it piss me off so much?
Well, there's two things that's happening. I don't necessarily think yesterday's surge higher was all every retail investor out there going, oh, I got to get in. I think a lot of it was the momentum type algorithm, guys, because, you know, once you start breaking through those technical levels, the momentum algorithms just get signaled to keep buying, keep buying, keep buying. And so they push it higher. But then there are the group that have been sitting here waiting patiently, waiting for the market to maybe pull back, thinking that, you know, the Fed was not going to cut rates and the market was going to pull back. And so they've got money sitting on the side, which, by the way, is invested in a money market fund earning 5.25%. So it's not like it's not doing anything. But then they see the way the market reacts yesterday. They go, oh, my God, I got to get in now. I can't wait any longer. And yes, to your point, they jump in and they push it higher, which typically for me and you suggests it's time to just sit back. Like yesterday, I did absolutely nothing. I didn't buy. I didn't sell. I sat here. We watched. I want to let the news marinate. I want to let investors digest what's happening. And then I fully expect that you know, we'll see a little bit of a pullback. And that's when guys like you and I will then put new money to work. I'm not chasing it. Absolutely not. To your point, you're not chasing risk way up here when the market's making all-time highs. Wait for it to settle in, see if it pulls back, watch what happens in the economy, and then put the money back to work.
Here's the question I have, Kenny. If you look up today and say, I'm going to go buy. If you're going to say, I want to buy one of these stocks that's making an all-time high, let's just say you want to buy the S&P 500. Futures today are 53.37, new all-time highs. What's your upside expectation when you're paying the highest price at which the thing has ever traded? It's never traded higher than it did or closed higher than it did yesterday. Never higher. Never higher than that. And you're going to buy it expecting upside and more upside versus downside? Tell me why.
Well, there's a couple of things going on. Because you know the old adage is new highs beget new highs, which might be fine.
Which is true.
Yeah, which momentum, is true.
Momentum works when it's working.
That's right. But at what point, to your point, now pricing in complete perfection, I own it, I'm going to continue to own it. Am I chasing up here? Absolutely not. Am I going to go along for the ride when it rises? Absolutely, which is exactly what you should be doing. But you got at some point, if you're a new investor and you want to start to get into the market, you do have to start somewhere. If it is a name that you want to own, you have to decide, okay, if I'm going to buy a little bit now, I'm only going to buy a little bit just to get my toes in the water. Because if it pulls back, you could always buy more and then bring your cost down and then participate. But you have to be very careful about getting caught up in that drama of the fear of missing out. Oh my God, this is the last opportunity I'm going to have. I have to get in now. That's always a mistake.
You know, and the worst thing they used to tell us when we were rookies, Kenny, and we were learning about options, was that the worst thing that can happen to you is that you make money on your first options trade.
Right, exactly.
The worst thing that can happen, because what do? You all of a sudden you think it's easy. All of a sudden, and because it's leveraged, and because it's a derivative, it can move hard and fast the other way just as quickly. And this is an area where sophisticated investors hang out. And when the rookie gets in there and thinks he or she knows what they're doing and that they finally got it, they don't got it. You don't got it. And you're not going to beat these algos, by the way. They're waiting for you.
That's absolutely right. But listen, you could say that the same could be true about making money on your first options trade and making money on your first, you know, if you buy stock in a trading account, that, you know, if you make money the very first time.
Of course, that's my point.
Right. You go, oh, my God, this is simple. Why haven't I done
this? You buy XYZ and it's up 2 points the next day and a point the next day after that. And you go, damn, this is good. I like this.
And then it's easy. And they go, oh, this is easy.
Yeah.
Right.
So, hey, Kenny, listen to this. I've got a young man I've been talking to for a few years who's come up with, he's got his certificate in coding and all of this. Anyway, I mean, he's a programmer now and he's moving into this stuff. But he was in the markets and he's come up with with his own algorithm, and he's added AI so that it can continue to change. And he's come up with a trading, sort of a historical black box kind of a thing. That's working, right? It's working.
Right.
They all work when you first look at them.
That's
so,
right.
So we take it to Barugian, and I talk to him about it, and he goes, yeah, I think that works. Now, let me tell you, though, when That starts, he's going to make money for about 6 months.
Right.
But there are AI programs out there looking for those patterns, even a small guy like this.
That's
And
right.
They will find him and they will defeat him. So in 6 months, when this stops working, it's not because his math stopped working. It's because they're onto him and he's going to have to change. And he's going to have to start doing copper futures and metal futures. And if that doesn't work, he's going to have to go to soybeans and, you know, pig futures and all orange, frozen orange juice, like, trading places, whatever it is. But those programs are out there to defeat you as a trader, even if you come up with a discipline. So this is a remarkably new, difficult environment for young traders and folks who think that they can really try and game something, don't you think?
1,000%. And I think it happens quicker. I'm not even sure 6 months. I think 6 months might be too long, right? I think the AI and the technology kind of searches for this stuff and goes out to destroy it even sooner than that, because it's possible. I mean, it's absolutely possible. Look what they're doing in AI on a daily basis. It's almost changing dramatically day by day, which speaks to why you should be in the space, why you should have exposure to the space. But to your point, you know, these guys that are writing these algorithms, you know, they're great one day, but then they're almost outdated the next.
Give me a final word for Fred and Ethel, Kenny. We got to go. Can't believe it. What are you doing? What should they be doing? And hey, is this the year to sell in May and go away?
Fred, I don't think so. Fred and Ethel should be enjoying this ride, right? Like I said in my note this morning, I'm not complaining about the market going up because I'm invested, so I'm enjoying the ride. It doesn't mean that I'm changing my strategy or suddenly going all in or taking the cash I have on the side, putting it to work today. To your point, you don't necessarily want to add risk at the highs when the market's making all new time highs. So if you've got a well-diversified portfolio, appreciate the fact that you got someone who's helping you guide that, created that portfolio, and then let it ride. No reason to get nervous. If the market backs off a little bit, that's when you're going to put more money to work.
Appreciate that person, and we appreciate Kenny Pulcari, head of Case Capital Advisors, Slate Stone's chief market strategist, and my very dear friend. Thank you, Kenny.
See you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
We're coming back with Dan Mahaffey and figure out what's going on. Hey, we've got presidential debates coming up. Oh, my God. You know, you don't really get to see them announce we're going to have like a five-car pileup out on the interstate. But it's coming on June 21st, I think's the date, folks. Biden and Trump, these guys are going to both get into that theater on a walker, each on their walker. They're going to hang on to those microphones. Their nurses will wipe their chins, and they're going to go after it, baby. Here we go. When we come back on the Farcast, please stay with us.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Farcast. Now it's time for political analyst Dan Mahaffey and your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Dan Mahaffey is the vice chairman of the Dr. Scholl Foundation, now based in Chicago, Illinois. He is still a scholar with the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, a Washington, D.C. think tank where he worked and headed policy for many years, and the senior political analyst on the Farcast. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning. Great to be talking to you.
Good morning. It's very nice to see you. Dan, I'm looking at the landscape this morning with the current president bickering about his debates upcoming with the former president and bring it on. I know you're free Wednesdays. President Biden said that's the day break he has in his court schedule right now. I beat you twice. I'll beat you again. Okay, so schoolyard politics are starting to heat up. And then we do have former President Trump on trial, sitting in a courtroom, being criticized for falling asleep or for muttering and getting chastised by the judge. We also have, it looks like, maybe a functional Washington, D.C. The headlines have almost gone away about Washington, D.C. We have calls for perhaps a change, if not at the very least in policy for Israel, if not a change in leadership in Israel. And we have a Ukraine that's a bit beyond the eight ball. We've got Josh Uminski coming up from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress in segment three. He's overseas. He's going to be joining us from Europe, giving us some insights there. So, Dan, where would you like to start? Have I got it right? Am I seeing the world right here?
I think a lot of the domestic stuff has died down. We even got through when we were talking about the last bits of business. That FAA bill is set. That's through. Congress was not so much, I would say, normal as just very ready to turn the page and get ready to the election. And I think that's the tone you also hear now. We're talking about these debates coming up, or debate the June 27th, you know, circle your calendars, folks, to strap in and perhaps realize we're stuck with these two. That's the thing that a lot of people are looking forward in sense now of. One, we haven't seen it this early in the debate process. Two, we're throwing out a lot of the script of that presidential commission on debates. This is not going to be like a debate we're used to in some of the aspects of that. But look, we finally have a actual electoral date, not a legal date, not a rally, not a Rose Garden press conference. Here's the two of them actually going at it. And I think each side has got to be cautiously optimistic that their guy will prevail. But I think both sides are really going to be setting low expectations for their person moving forward. The Biden team, of course, worried about his age, his performance, how he will do in a room with someone like the former President Trump, someone who can easily take over a room. We've seen him do it before, but also how well prepared will the former president be with his legal difficulties? Will he appear tired or churlish? How does he come off to an audience that isn't just his supporters? Those are the other questions that his side is worrying about as both sides have this calendar, that June 27th date circled very thoroughly. Stars.
I sent Leland Vittert a note after I watched his show last night or the night before. Anyway, I sent him a note and I said, given these recent polls where President Trump is surging, maybe the Trump campaign should just endeavor to keep him off the campaign trail, looking a little angry and petulant in a courtroom somewhere near you, the version of Biden's basement. I mean, really, the less he talks, the better he seems to do. He just has to look pissed off and it seems to work. And maybe the Democrats should figure out some way to get President Biden charged with something that he could get angry about and look petulant to, and get him back in the basement. Because more exposure time for Biden is not working for Biden, and less is for Trump. Is there a lesson there? Do you think?
I'm being cynical,
but I think there might be. I mean, actually,
you're on to something. And there's part of it. I'll oversimplify these, but I'm going to be a bit Tom Friedman. In the absence of data, I'm going to pull together conversations I've had with folks around the Midwest, which is the one part of it is that you see with Trump, and we've spoken about this before, is he the firefighter or the arsonist in a world of flame?
Well, isn't he both? And hasn't he always been both? Hasn't he started fires that he can?
And that's what Biden needs to do. Is Biden is not winning when he's talking about the voter does not care about the rate of inflation going down. They want to see actual prices go down. So he needs to move away from his economic message and more onto this is the guy that could replace me.
I wish we were on live video, because just as you started talking about Biden and Trump, your dog started attending to himself on the sofa behind you there, cleaning its privates. And the timing couldn't have been more perfect. That was great.
I think the dog, Penny, knows exactly what to think about politics.
Yes,
now that she's moved outside of Washington.
This is a reason to trust dogs. Just trust the dogs, folks.
You know, but the other hand for Biden is, and I say this pejoratively, but he needs something like a Grenada.
Yeah.
You know, what is a moment that he can show he's still a leader?
The guy's got a Ukraine, and the guy's got an Israel. The guy's got a conflict with China, and he's taking up tariffs. I mean, he's got his conflicts. He just can't position himself and make himself look like he's in control of any of it.
And the problem is those are conflicts where the moves made in those conflicts might be decisions that our children thank us for. those are the problems with those positions there, that you don't have the electoral time cycle when you're dealing with those conflicts.
Okay, so you're saying he needs something quicker and neater to make him set where he can declare victory and move on, because these aren't going to be, there are going to be no victories to be had in any of these areas in the next 5 months. Is that
correct?
Where you're going? Okay, and yeah, that totally makes sense. So where does President Biden find a victory? And all of the polls are saying now that President Trump's the next president, and folks are already doing their calculus. Wall Street's doing its calculus, ladies and gentlemen. What do those next 4 years of a Trump presidency mean? It's going to mean a lot for tax policy domestically. It's going to mean a lot for spending. It could mean a complete change at the Federal Reserve. Listen, folks, you can get upset about this if you want to. You can wail and gnash your teeth and rend your garments, and that's all fine and good. Sit in your sackcloth and ashes. That isn't going to get you through your investing and economy and work life over the next 5 to 10 years. What is saying, what's this thing going to look like and how do I position myself best to endure this and benefit from it? And those are what you do. You endure this and you benefit from it. How are you going to do it for you and your family? And what are the changes, real changes going to be? Be pissed off later and be practical now. That's always been my best advice for investing, by the way, getting through life. Far's best advice. Get pissed off later, but be practical now. Dan, you think we're looking towards more of a Trump presidency, or is it still way too early to make any call like that?
There's a lifetime in politics remaining. I'll go back to our timeline. You know, we've moved ahead, but again, the election were held today. Donald Trump is president. And that's where, you know, as you say, you look at what would the impact be. It would be beneficial if you're looking for a low tax environment. Certainly, if you're in the energy industry, those are areas you'd be looking towards as opportunities. Those are the areas that are really, I think, hoping right now for a Trump victory. On the other hand, the Biden administration, they want to, again, try and turn around this economic message. And I would say, if they're going to do that, they need to have less of their economists out there and perhaps, get some of the folks who have benefited from their policies speaking for a change. The voter doesn't care what Jared Bernstein, Janet Yellen have to say about these things. They need to know examples from people who are actually being helped.
I care about what Janet Yellen says. I've known Jared Bernstein for a long time. People say that Larry Summers is egotistical. You spend 20 minutes with Jared Bernstein, I dare you. Holy God. There's a lot of Jared Bernstein and Jared Bernstein, and he loves every minute of it. Okay. But you're right. You're right. You've got to get down to the numbers and don't listen to all the talk. Ignore the screaming and the yelling and pay attention to the price of fish at the fish market. That's the advice. Dan, give me your final word of what you're watching this week to next week. And is anything keeping you awake at night right now?
Well, what I'm really looking at is as Russia and China get closer, what are we seeing with this bonhomie with Putin and Xi? What does this mean in terms of China's industrial support for Russia? And looking at these closer ties between two nations who really want to push back against the United States in any way they can.
Are these foxhole allies, or are they trying to do something stronger strategically? And is Putin really in a position to present any sort of a real partnership to a country the size of China?
Well, with China, it's, again, can they get them the gas and energy resources that China needs? That's taking time with building the infrastructure. But the Russians now understand that they are dependent on China largely economically. They are dependent for these electronics and more advanced components.
Dan Mahaffey is the vice chairman of the Dr. Scholl Foundation, also Center of the Study of the Presidency and Congress, and our senior political analyst on the Farcast. Dan, thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, we're coming back with Josh Huminski from Europe. Figure out what's going on over there and what are the Europeans going to do? Think about this. What do Europeans do? What do European governments do if they think that President Trump is coming back and he is going to cut off more money to NATO and he's going to make them stand on their own? And they're not going to have the support from the U.S. And are they going to form closer coalitions among each other and between? And maybe think about shutting us out. And what does that do to our economy? When we come back on the Farcast, please stay with us.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr. We appreciate you listening into the Farcast this week. And now to introduce this week's special guest, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast as we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world, bringing you insiders to better understand our world. It's always a great pleasure to talk to our friend Josh Huminsky, Senior Vice President for National Security and Intelligence Programs at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, a Washington, D.C. think tank. He manages Center's research on Euro-Atlantic security. He's talking to us from London today. He studied at King's College London, did a dissertation on energy security. Interesting when you think about what's going on in the Middle East. And also from the University of Connecticut for his undergraduate degree, where I did some graduate work myself. And the University of Connecticut does not have a bad basketball team, just in case you've been paying attention, folks. Basketball's okay at UConn. One of those things you can play indoors when you get that far north. You get further south, look at the baseball teams and the golf teams. But up there, look at basketball, maybe football. Josh, welcome back to the Farcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we appreciate you taking your time this afternoon in London. We're recording in D.C. and in Naples at about 9:15 this morning, but hope you've had some lunch and ready to go with us here. Josh, what takes you to London right now? And you have had some government meetings, some of which you can't discuss. Tell us what you can discuss.
Yeah, it's been very interesting. So I'm over here the first week, as you said, for a series of meetings as part of the research I'm doing on Euro-Atlantic security and the future of U.S. cooperation in NATO as it pertains to Ukraine and Russia. Then next week, I'm participating in the London Defense Conference, which is co-hosted by my alumnus, King's College London, alma mater, excuse me, that's the word I was looking for, King's College London, and Reaction Magazine over here. And it's a fantastic conference last year, and it looks to be a great conference this year.
And what are you learning? Okay, so tell me what you're learning about the state of politics. I mean, Rishi Sunak is saying that he's going to commit more money, I guess, in the future to the defense budget. I guess that's happening across Europe. Is that in a reaction to a potential Donald Trump presidency where Europe feels like they have to stand more on their own?
Well, I think it's more of a reaction to the realities that Russia invaded Ukraine. It took a lot of countries by surprise, some more so than others. But the increase in defense expenditure is something that the United States has been demanding, really, but quite politely, I should say, for successive administrations. I mean, President Bush did it. President Obama did it. And President Trump was the first one who really threatened to use the stick as opposed to the quiet diplomacy behind the scenes, you know, threatening to pull out of NATO, threatening now to only defend countries that spend the floor threshold of 2% of GDP. So I think the real driver was more of Russia and Ukraine and the Prime Minister Sunak's decision to announce that they're going to go to 2.5% of GDP by 2030 and committing about £100 billion over the next 10 years. Is this a reaction to the reality that we are now in a conventional conflict on the continent of Europe, which we haven't seen since the Second World War?
Did the European governments get caught in a period of complacency where everything's just going to be fine and we don't need to worry about it and we can sort of rely on NATO, which means we're going to rely on the United States and that nothing really goes wrong over here and Russia wouldn't dare? Was that they just get caught with their pants down?
I think some more than others, because there was certainly wishful thinking by some governments. If you look to Germany as a great example, that was enjoying the benefits of very cheap energy resources from Russia, didn't really want to spend on defense because of the legacy of history. France, to some degree, was warning about the brain death of NATO, that it didn't really have a purpose at the time. Eastern Europe is a different story. I mean, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, former Soviet states, client states, occupied states, were very bullish about warning about the risks of Putin and the risks of a Russian invasion. Certainly the Baltics, or sort of the Scandinavian countries now, with Finland and Sweden having joined, they spent quite a bit on defense. So it was very uneven, but I think the general sense was that most Europeans, in inverted commas, didn't think that war was going to return to the European continent and didn't spend accordingly. I mean, if you look at the state of the German military, you look at the state of the Italian military, you look at the state of the French militaries, consistent underinvestment in the absence of a clearly defined threat, which Russia has manifested by its invasion.
Okay. So from here, tell me about your assessment of the stability of Europe, because to Americans, this is very important economically. We're watching Russia and China seem to get closer. And I asked Mahaffey, are these just foxhole allies? I mean, I understand that China wants oil, but really, why do they have? Do they really have to pander to Russia, or is this a way to stack up against the United States, which I would call a foxhole ally? And does Europe have a greater concern about this new emerging closeness, nascent? It's not really nascent, but it's been underway for a while between China and Russia. Would European leaders have concerns?
I think Europe is concerned more about the immediate conflict in Ukraine and with Russia. That's their primary motivating factor. China, in its relationship with Russia in particular, China is allowing Russia to import various dual-use technologies. They aren't providing necessarily offensive arms, in inverted commas, there. And China gets the benefit of tying down resources and tying down attention in Europe while the United States wants to pivot to the Indo-Pacific. So it is a distraction in some ways, and a very serious one that needs to be dealt with to support democracy and support European security and stability. But the longer that Russia plays in Europe, in Ukraine, the more advantages Xi Jinping gets from it. Now, they've talked about the friendship without limits, whatever you want to call it. There's, of course, going to be limits on it, because China doesn't want to antagonize the United States unnecessarily. It wants to adjust the thermostat a bit, change the temperature, and use that to a strategic advantage. Now, China wants cheap oil, wants cheap energy resources, and looks at Russia very much like that. Now, there's a confluence of interests, and I think that's a very distinctive point than saying they are like strategic partners or strategic allies. China is not going to do anything through Russia that is going to disadvantage its own strategic position. If it can create advantages for itself by destabilizing things and applying pressure elsewhere, that will happen.
A confluence of interest sort of sounds like the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
There's something to that, yes.
Okay. Enemy of my enemy is my friend. So we're seeing all of this kind of move down the road. It sounds like this is going to happen regardless of whether we're looking forward to a Donald Trump or a Joe Biden, those being the only two choices apparently we have in the free world. They're going to do that anyway, are they?
I think absolutely. I think the reality is Russia is now severed economically from Europe. And the likelihood that the European Union and European countries will resume relationships with Russia as and when the conflict ends, and we don't know when that's going to be. There is a very unclear end date or end goal for this conflict. They're not going to resume it immediately. So Russia only has one direction to look, and that's going to be the global south, but predominantly China, as well as exporting resources through India. A lot of the oil that goes, India is benefiting from cheap energy prices from Russia, recycling it effectively, washing it, processing it, and sending it back to other economies. So regardless of whether it's President Biden or whether it's President Trump, the reality is that Putin's invasion of Ukraine has forced the accommodation and the closing of relations, between Russia and China.
So a secure Europe is a stable Europe, and things that are stable are pretty good for markets, are pretty good for the U.S. economy, are pretty good as we predict strength from our trade partners around the world. Now, Europe is not an enormous trade partner for the United States. I mean, yes, they are and they aren't. They're just not, they don't move the needle as much, certainly as China does, or certainly not as much as Japan does. But, you know, it's we pay attention. strategically on the military side, in the way that, of course, they have Russia largely surrounded, except for the Asian quarters. That's more important. That really is more important, that those are democratic countries by and large. Those matter, give or take the English monarchy. Rishi Sunak, Prime Minister of the UK, of England, he is facing an election, and it looks like he'll stay in place, does it? The Brits like this guy?
Actually, no. So Prime Minister Sunak has to call an election no later than, I believe, December 17th, after which point an automatic dissolution of parliament will happen, and then it'll have to be called before January 25th of next year. So he can call the election at any point up until mid-December. He is facing what will probably be a pretty resounding defeat for just not only him, but the entire Tory party, to the Conservatives. After close to 13 years in power and multiple prime ministers.
Why are they going to throw him out? He seems like a smart guy, very, very wealthy guy. So he doesn't have an alternative agenda, it doesn't seem. What's he been doing wrong, or what has he been doing that's so unpopular that they want to get rid of him?
The reality is that, as I said, after 13 years in power, the Conservative Party is basically intellectually and politically exhausted. They've gone through successive prime ministers. That you had Prime Minister Truss, who effectively collapsed the economy in her 49 days in office. And we're also dealing with the legacy of Brexit. Brexit consumed just about every single bit of political bandwidth from the decision that the vote was cast to the leaving the European Union.
Okay, so what happens next? They get rid of Sunak? You don't think Sunak survives this then? Doesn't sound like.
I don't believe so. If we go by the recent by-election results, the Labour Party will win, and it'll be Sir Keir Starmer as the Prime Minister.
It'll be whom?
Sir Keir Starmer.
Sir Keir Starmer. That does not sound like Lord Athington Wellington Coleridge the 16th that you would expect over there. Give me the name one more time.
It's Keir Starmer.
Keir Starmer. What will he bring? What will Sir Keir Starmer bring to the British Empire over there?
Well, I think the hope is, based on the announcement that he made today of his kind of six key priorities, which are very similar to Tony Blair's five commitments on the eve of the 1997 election. It's a new administration, a new government coming into office, bringing with them sort of the Labour Party. What's quite interesting about Labour is, until today, they've largely been defined by the fact that they are not the Tories. It has been very difficult to pin down what the Labour Party platform would be.
All right.
They released six.
If I'm Biden, I'm going to run by saying I'm not Trump. And if I'm Trump, I'm going to run by saying I'm not Biden. Got it. Now, you.
It's like that old ABC, anything but Clinton.
Anything but Clinton. ABC. You received a graduate degree in war studies from King's College. You also studied security and others. But war studies, as you look at what's going on in Ukraine, as you look at what's going on in the Middle East, first, let's start with Ukraine, and I want to do this one really quickly. Are we going to be doing Ukraine a year from now, and will Ukraine be able to hold the line against Russia here after we go through everything through the summer and the arms and everything else?
There's not a quick answer for that in a year's time, because there's a lot of variables. My quick answer, if I had to say it, is yes, we will be dealing with Ukraine in a year's time.
And there'll still be a war with Russia?
There will still be Russia will still be in Ukraine, and the United States and NATO will be arming Ukraine to defend itself against Russia, yes.
Tell me about the Middle East, and will we still have that war in Palestine with Israel a year from now? Will it escalate and involve Iran again, or were they so sufficiently humiliated, no matter what they say in public, that they're going to think twice before they fire another rocket?
Well, again, I think being very careful to separate the bits, the Israeli involvement in Gaza will almost certainly be continuing in some form or fashion, probably transitioning to a counterinsurgency type campaign. Iran and its proxy activities will continue in the Middle East. I think if we're talking about the tit for tat, where Israel struck the Iranian consulate in Syria, And then Iran responded in kind and was resoundingly defeated by a coalition effort to intercept those missiles and drones. I think that is on ice for the moment because it was performative for Tehran. They got humiliated and quite clearly saw just how aligned not just Gulf states and Saudi Arabia, but the United States, United Kingdom, France, other countries, and Jordan in particular, were aligned against Iran's response and retaliation out of a desire to keep escalation limited. So I think, will there be proxy conflicts with Iran and Israel? Absolutely. That's been ongoing. That won't change. But I think that the cooler heads have prevailed, at least for right now. But I certainly could be proven wrong because it is the Middle East.
There's a perception, I think, Josh, one that I share, that the world feels like it's becoming a more dangerous place. Middle East and wars and conflicts that we didn't have 10 years ago, or maybe, I'm in my American bubble and I wasn't paying close enough attention, which is entirely possible. Tell me, do you agree that the world's a more dangerous place? And will this continue to escalate? Because when we've seen, nobody's been talking about Taiwan in a while, when nobody's been talking about all the boats in the South China Sea, and who's claiming and building islands and who's doing what through that area. Is it continuing to escalate? And how do you see this playing out? And finally, what keeps you awake at night? We're already over time. Can't believe it. This has been great.
Well, I think we always suffer from a risk of presentism. We think the times in which we live are somehow unique compared to other times.
Yes.
I think what is unique and different is that the United States' ability and the ability of allies to actually influence global affairs has diminished dramatically. And we're seeing that playing out in all these conflicts. There's only
why
so
has
much
it diminished? Why has the U.S.'s ability to influence been so diminished? I mean, it is, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, there's no question that Ronald Reagan, during his presidency, had a lot of respect. And when he barked, people listened, whether they agreed with him or not, they had to listen. They don't seem to listen anymore.
No, they don't. And I think there's a fundamental erosion sort of American power and prestige. We spent 20 years in the war on terrorism in Iraq and Afghanistan and achieved nothing effectively and withdrew from Afghanistan in a very disastrous manner. And that erodes American prestige. America didn't support its allies in Afghanistan. I keep coming back to that one as an example. The tools of power have been spread out and diffused from Washington. Silicon Valley and Wall Street have as much influence as Washington, D.C. does. The world has become much more globalized and much more interconnected.
Say that again. Silicon Valley, say that again. There's your line, ladies and gentlemen. You want to listen to the one line from Josh Uminski? You just heard it. Listen to this.
The sources of power have diffused from Washington, D.C., and now Silicon Valley and Wall Street Journal are as influential as Washington, D.C. can be.
That's a bit chilling. And I think I might add to that, if you want to, Hollywood. If you throw Hollywood and pictures in our influence, not only financially, but in terms of our ability to spread a message, we'd add that as well.
And that's just on the domestic side. If we look at other sources of international power, Beijing is a player. We have to acknowledge that. The European Union, they're a player. Delhi is a player. So the sources of power and influence are not the ones where they once were in terms of the great Reagan era.
Josh, what keeps you awake at night? I got to go.
I think it's the unknown unknowns, the things that we don't see coming that's going to exacerbate and strain already limited resources and attention. I mean, heaven forbid we get another serious attack on the United States or here in London, for example, that's going to necessitate returning to Syria, returning to Iraq, or something else that's unanticipated.
Okay. Josh Uminski from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress joining us today from London. Thank you so much, Josh.
Thank you very much for having me. I look forward to joining again.
We do too. We really do. We learn so much. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for another Farcast as we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world. I've learned a lot on this particular show. I hope you have too. We'll be back again next week bringing you insiders from around the world and around the country so that we can better understand and navigate our world, understand what we're hearing in the media and how it's going to affect us in terms of our national security, in terms of our economy, and how we can position ourselves to both endure and enjoy the future ahead of us. For everybody at Hightower Advisors, Farr Miller in Washington, my producer, Harry Jennings, I'm Michael Farr. Thanks so much for being with us. Please share us on your social media. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.
That's a wrap on this week's episode of the Farrcast.
Thanks for being with us, and thanks to our guest, Kenny Polcari, Dan Mahaffey, and special guest from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, Joshua Uminski. The Farcast is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and comes to you weekly for free on all major podcast platforms, including Spotify, TuneIn, and Apple Podcasts. Stream past episodes as well as subscribe so you never miss a new one. We love reading all of your notes and try to reply to as many as we can. You can reach us at hjennings@farmiller.com. Let us know any questions you have about past episodes or questions you'd like us to answer in upcoming shows. Please be aware that anytime we or any of our guests mention a specific company, sector, or refer to performance in relation to an earnings report, news headline, or economic trend, it is not a recommendation to buy or sell. Review the risks and rewards of any investment with your financial advisor for what specific investment and general strategy is appropriate for you before you make any investment decision. As always, if we can be of assistance at Farr Miller in Washington, please reach out to me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. We are here to help, and I'm happy to arrange for any of our listeners an appointment with one of our financial professionals to review your portfolio, your needs, and your goals. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. Thanks for listening to the Farcast, Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Farr Miller in Washington is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Some investment professionals may also be registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. Securities are offered through Hightower Securities, LLC. All information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC have not independently verified the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties, expressed or implied, as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions or results obtained from the use of this information. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates assume no liability for any action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to the information. This podcast and the materials contained herein were created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented in any way to any entity as tax or legal advice. Clients are urged to consult their tax and/or legal advisors for related questions.